All right. So first of all, clearing the decks of some of the important mail response. You know, they talk about interactive television. We have interactive radio right here. I'm sitting right here with a shred of crappy interactivity from a listener who doesn't even have the guts to sign his name or hers. But I'm going to respond to it anyway, because that's the kind of host I am. That's the kind of desperate-to-fill-time host I am. Listener, this is reported by a third party, innocent third party who just took the phone call. Listener did not like the fact that Eminem's lyrics was recommended. I did not like the fact that plurals was singularized. Me, personally, that's me, but hey, I'm just reading this. Quote, should not be making a big deal out of Eminem's lyrics, unquote. So it's me that's making a big deal out of Eminem's lyrics. I see. I get it. Thanks. Thanks, anonymous listener, for paying so damn much attention to both grammar and the news. But please, some more interactivity is always welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you know that many public radio stations share space with institutions of what's laughingly called higher learning. And the Show Dome is similarly domiciled on a college campus, don't you know? And so it is that I was faced upon entering the Le Show Dome today with a large sign that bore these words, "Run for Student Government." And it, you know, made me think. There's a lot of talk these days, about, especially during election seasons, about the apathetic electorate, and especially the kids. The kids are so turned off the system. And every year, fewer people vote in our elections. And they're older and older. It's skewing in exactly the opposite way from the television audience, which is interesting. The voting demographic and the television viewing demographic are moving in different directions. Just an observation. I make nothing of that. But there are so many explanations derived for why people are losing interest in the electoral system. You know, we need campaign finance reform, the sleaze, the this, the that, the complications, the this, the lying, the hypocrisy. We've always had all of that. But one thing that's relatively new is the public school system. That's an invention of the 20th century, basically, in most parts of the country. And B, even more recent, student government. Now, I don't know about you, but when I went to school, the biggest joke in the world was student government. Here were these kids who basically were learning all of the unnecessary, all of the really worst parts of politics, the, hey, how are you, please like me parts of politics, and none of the actually exercising power, because, of course, they had none. So it's a perfect lesson in the emptiness of democracy. I asked the question, is the lack of interest in the democratic system that supposedly we have in this country on the part of our young people due to the fact that there is, in fact, such a thing as student government? And should we, in fact, be discouraging people from not only running for it, but participating in it in any way? That's this week's Question of the Week from Hello, Welcome to the Show.
Turning of the tide. little shoes, cheap perfume, creaking bed in the hotel room. Oh, you can't hide from the turning of the tide. Shabby dress, did I find some tender moment there in your caress? The boys all say you look so fine, but don't come back for a second time. You can't hide from the turning of the tide.
Shot in a hollow sky. She left me without warning. Sooner than the dogs could bark, faster than the sun rode, down to the banks on an old mule car. She took a flatboat across the shallow, left me in my tears to drown. She left a baby daughter. Now the river's wide and deep and brown, but she's crossing muddy water. Standing in the fields, beer out come November, and a bitter heart will not reveal a spring that love remembers. When that sweet brown girl of mine, hair black as a raven, we broke the bread and drank the wine from a jug that she'd been saving, left me in my tears to drown. And she left a baby daughter. Now the river's wide and deep and brown, and she's crossing muddy water. Baby's crying and the daylight's gone, and that big old tree is groaning in a rush of wind and a river song. I can hear my true love moaning, crying for her baby child. Oh, crying for her husband, crying for that river's wild to take her from her loved ones. Left me in my tears to drown. She left a baby daughter. Now the river's wide and deep and brown, and she's crossing muddy water. The river's wide and deep and brown. She's crossing muddy water.
Hello, welcome to the show from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, by request, all new this week, just, you know, by request only. And since, you know, I started this broadcast with a question, I just want to report on the issue of interactivity. No student body presidents have called to dissent. So I guess I'm right. But having begun the broadcast with a question, let me now continue with a possible answer to another question. As you know, if you're a regular listener to this broadcast, and if not, please seek professional medical help as soon as possible. I've been remarking for some time now over the amazing fact that virtually every street in the environs of Los Angeles, Southern California, even the home of the homeless, where there's money to burn. Every street seems to be under repair at exactly the same time. You can't go. I mean, it's usually I maintain that it's pretty easy to get around here as long as you stay off the freeways. But tourists and strangers, please take the freeways, won't you? But that rule has been violated because no matter what street you turn onto, there's construction going on. How can every street be under construction at the same time? How can they have planned it this way? What could be the point? Well, I believe I've discovered the point, and the answer came to me again when I read a sign. And it's a sign I'd seen a lot in the last couple of years. I think I first saw it in Texas, driving across the country. Whoa, what a good idea that was. A couple of years ago. And I'd never seen it before, but I guess it first appeared in Texas. And since then, it's sprouted all over the place. And it's a very simple sign. It simply says, you see it on freeways sometimes, traffic fines doubled in construction zones. And I thought about that. First thought I had was, well, there are construction workers there. They might be endangered by reckless driving. It's probably a good idea. Yeah. And then we come to metropolitan areas like Los Angeles, Santa Monica, always can use more money. You know, they were cash rich 6 months ago. Now all of a sudden state and local governments are saying, whoa, wait, the economy's slowing down. We're spending a lot of money now. We thought we were rich. And what happened? They're not saying that, of course, because that's just bad comic reading. But they're saying something like that. And of course, there are only two real painless ways to increase revenue. One is to just bust into more suspected crack houses, whether or not there's any reason to believe that there's crack in there, and seize the contents under the forfeiture laws. That goes straight to the bottom line of law enforcement. That's a good technique. And the other is just to make every street a construction zone, thereby immediately doubling the value of every ticket that every policeman writes. I think I'm onto something here, ladies and gentlemen. If you just make the entire world a construction zone, you've doubled your traffic ticket revenue overnight. Let's see if any student body presidents call to correct that. In the meantime, Oscar De La Hoya has put his Bel Air house back on the market at $4.75 million. The boxer singer. What? Did I miss something? I mean, I knew he sang. First listed the home almost a year ago at $5.5 million. Realism is invading the space of Oscar De La Hoya. The house has 8 bedrooms and 10 baths. Whew. That's a lot of bathing. In 10,000 square feet, among its features are a gym, screening room, game room, pool, and tennis court. The house is reached by way of a 300-foot driveway. There's your exercise right there. Get rid of the pool and the tennis court. Just run down the driveway to get home. Built in 1990, the house underwent a complete redesign since De La Hoya bought it in 1997. And there's information about his records in the real estate column. That's probably put there by his realtor, don't you think? Anthony Kiedis, lead singer of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, has purchased a Hollywood Hills home for about $2.2 million. It has he bought it before the holidays. This is a newspaper, ladies and gentlemen? What holiday do they mean? President's Day? I don't think so. So they were just sitting on this. They were sitting on this red-hot Anthony Kiedis item until right now. For no good reason. 6 bedrooms, 6 baths, and 4,500 square feet was built in the 1940s. It has an arched entry, wood beam ceilings, colorful tile work, iron fixtures, and fountains. And Broadway composer, lyricist Jerry... It's a musical theme kind of a deal. I guess that's why they were saving the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Guy, to have a theme column, you said, don't you? Broadway composer lyricist Jerry Herman, who wrote the songs for such musicals as You Find Out on Your Own Time, has put a Beverly Hills home on the market that he bought in December. Whew. That's a quick flip. He bought it in December. That's when Anthony Kiedis bought his home. He only made the paper now. Jerry Herman's already turned around and sold it. I got whiplash just from reading this. Herman spruced up the home, and now he wants to move on. I guess that's good advice for all of us. So, who's Michael Jackson hanging out with nowadays? Hands? Any guesses? In the Celebrities Find Their Own Level department, Michael Jackson is now hanging out with Uri Geller. For the kids in the audience, Uri Geller gained fame in the 70s. Was it really the 70s? Yes, it was. As, what can one say that won't sound immediately risible? Nothing. He gained fame as a guy who could bend spoons with the power of his mind. I know, your parents were gullible. What can I do? Uri Geller, hanging out with Michael Jackson. He tried to heal Michael's broken foot. Did you know Michael Jackson had a broken foot? He was trying to use part of it as a nose. No, I'm sorry, that's not true. That's the part that's not true. He had hoped to heal Jackson before Jackson turned up as the best man at Uri Geller's wedding. So he bent something to his will, did Uri Geller. He spent an hour running his hands over Jackson's foot and then confessed, "I'm not a healer, but I hope that what I did with Michael will encourage his foot." He's not a healer. He's an encourager. "Will encourage his foot to get better more quickly. Come on, foot. Come on. I told Michael to spend a minute or two every day imagining his bones healing." That's time out from imagining his career healing and other things. Jackson broke his foot in a fall at his California ranch, tripped over a child. No, he did not. Please, don't even put those thoughts in my mind. Another friend of his, since you asked, is Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. Boteach. Shmuley, to those of us who know him well, who has written a book called Confessions of a Rabbi and a Psychic. So he's not just a rabbi, he's a psychic. Jackson made a promotional appearance in England just before he spoke at Oxford. I'm sorry. Hand up raised now. This is true. Spoke at Oxford. Who else spoke at Oxford recently? Another client of Johnny Cochran's. That's right. And I've been invited. Makes me think twice, doesn't it? Jackson, at his appearance to support the book launch of Confessions of a Rabbi and a Psychic, was clutching a postcard in the shape of a baby. Clutching a postcard in the shape of a baby, ladies and gentlemen, because I guess there are laws in Britain. Maybe there are, maybe there aren't. News of the media world? Sure. A couple of wonderful items this week. I don't know if you caught this. John King, who is CNN's chief White House correspondent, but maybe not for long, was disgusted by the coziness of the host of the inaugural gala with George W. Bush. The host was Larry King. The email that John King sent to his bosses became public this week. He wrote, did John King, "Today I watched in shame and horror as Larry King not only was master of ceremonies at a Bush inaugural event, but also as we put him live on the air, first introducing some entertainment, then as he shamelessly rushed on stage to hug the president-elect and entertainer Ricky Martin. People in the newsroom are grumbling. People around the town I have to work in every day are laughing." The subject line of the email was, quote, "Some of us have jobs to do," unquote. A friend of mine pointed out that no similar criticism emerged when that footage of Larry King hugging Denise Rich and Bill Clinton, when he got a saxophone from Denise Rich, ran on every network. One CNN staffer said, "If Ted Turner were dead, he'd be rolling over in his grave." Maybe Ted's got other fish to fry. He's busy apologizing for a joke he made about Ash Wednesday. He walked into the CNN Washington newsroom, saw four female employees wearing ashes on their foreheads, and said, "I thought they just came back from the Seattle earthquake." And then when told that it was Ash Wednesday, he said, "I guess you guys are Jesus freaks. You should be working at Fox." Ted Turner has since apologized. And a little closer to home, you know, who cares about Ted and the Kings? Did you notice the funding message that appeared at the end of some NPR broadcasts recently? Support for NPR comes from the state of Kuwait in memory of the 10th anniversary of Kuwait's liberation. On the web at KuwaitThanksAmerica.com. That set off some alarm bells, even from NPR's own ombudsman. Kuwait government has a history of using public relations campaigns to influence American public opinion. An NPR spokeswoman said the NPR decision to accept underwriting from Kuwait followed normal procedures. We've heard about these normal procedures before. Just a month ago, you heard about the billboard NPR is selling on the side of its building in Washington. Its standards for reviewing customers for that follow normal procedures as well. We don't know what the normal procedures are, though, but they're normal. That's the reassuring part. Ladies and gentlemen, please don't worry. Everything's normal. But it was regarded as a major breach of journalistic integrity to many listeners and industry observers. Harper's Magazine publisher John MacArthur reported the Kuwaiti government hired the public relations firm Hill & Knowlton to mobilize American sentiment in favor of getting involved in the Gulf War by arguing it was human rights and not just oil at stake. That was the line pushed by a PR firm hired by the Kuwait government. Part of that plan, designed by Hill & Knowlton, involved presenting false claims in 1990 in front of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus and the UN Security Council that Iraqi soldiers had taken babies out of incubators and left them to die. Some of the most compelling evidence came from a 15-year-old named Naira, who claimed to be a Kuwaiti with firsthand knowledge of the situation. Unknown to the congressman and the media, Naira was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. At the time, says MacArthur, it was the most sophisticated and expensive PR campaign ever run in the U.S. by a foreign government. Author of a book. NPR has accepted money from foreign governments before. In 1999, Germany sponsored a message to commemorate the fall of the Berlin Wall. But it troubled NPR's ombudsman, Jeffrey Dvorkin, who wrote, "Journalists at NPR are never in contact with corporate or foundation sponsors, but just as important as the reality of influence is the appearance of influence. Kuwait remains in the news. The NPR reports from time to time from Iraq." MacArthur said what's extraordinary is that NPR took the money. Kuwait has been doing this for years, buying American public opinion. Says a leading critic, Robert McChesney, NPR needs to draw, and this is his quote, "a line in the sand." Given the country under discussion, that's probably the best place in which to draw the line. Sorry, I was possessed by David Brinkley's ghost for a minute there.
When that pitcher gets off a curveball,
does that mean that there wasn't no ball at all? When the preacher catches you asleep,
does that mean that you're some kind of a creep? You'll be standing on the corner looking like a stupid loner waiting for a bus. But the bus will pass you by and you couldn't catch its eye. You can bite its dust.
And your wit's not all that it could be.
And you reach out for something so impatiently.
And your days turn into months on end.
It's time to flip the page and to start up again.
Time to roll over and see what other tricks you got. Time to move over, let the new guy take a shot. Strike it while it's hot, cause later there might not be any room for thought.
When the rain clouds pass and it stays dry, does that mean that there wasn't no clouds up in the sky?
And when the rain comes back and it pours good,
does that mean that you finally understood?
So you want to feed your belly and you jump into the deli looking for a bite.
And you have a close encounter with somebody at the counter looking for a fight.
when that store runs all out of your size? Does that rocket your plans up into other skies? What's your combination of the latest compilation? Does it need interpretation to avoid a reputation?
Can we simplify, make it work? Time to roll over, see what other tricks you got. Time to move over, let the new guy take a shot. Strike it while it's hot, cause later there might not be any room for thought. All records that have gone before.
And you turn yourself a 180. Does that mean that your eyes are looking backwardly?
So you like to turn around and see the other side of town, but it's not easy.
No, no, no. And every time you look, it seems like they took away the scenery. Ooh,
it's a view that you're not quite used to. But since when did that ever seem to bother you? Time to roll over, see what other tricks you got. Time to move over, let the new guy take a shot. Strike it while it's hot, later there might not be any room for thought. Strike it while it's hot,
strike it while it's hot.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is All in All. All in All, a regular once-over, not so lightly, on the people behind the issues, behind the headlines, above the news. I'm Milton Getzler in Washington. This week, the nightmare of a student shooting at his classmates on a school campus returned to the front page of America's attention, replacing for several tragic days the Bush tax cut and the Clinton pardons. Talk shows and news broadcasts have focused on the subject of youthful violence, its putative causes, and its possible cures, almost as devotedly as if all the students involved had been featured on the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. The suspect in this week's case, Andy Williams, was reported to be seen by fellow students as a big-eared nerd, subjected to repeated bouts of ridicule and bullying. And it's to this pattern that our guest today seeks, in his own nerdish way, to call our wandering attention. He's Christian Borgers, executive chairman of the National Association of Geeks, Dorks, and Nerds. And he's in our million-dollar digital interview studio with our own Ira Zipkin. Mr. Borgers, first of all, just to clear up any possible confusion, how do you identify yourself as a nerd, a dork, or a geek?
Ira, that's one of the most tragically misunderstood things about the kids I represent. Even they don't know the answer to that question. See, every previous minority group has had one advantage of at least knowing who they are. Geeks and dorks and nerds are just left to wonder until very often it's too late.
Well, strictly speaking, a geek is some kind of obsessed tech head.
Well, really strictly speaking, and I know this only because I saw it on the show my mom was watching on A&E, a geek is a dude who bites the heads off chickens in the carnival.
Well, in any case, nerds and dorks are seen as ungainly kids, kids with oddly prominent facial or bodily features.
Sure, jug ears like mine, big noses, thick glasses, thin kids who clearly aren't attractive enough to be model material but who eat just as little as the pretty kids do.
The boys who stay home and watch Star Trek DVDs on prom night.
Yes, yes, sir. That's my constituency. And partly because the last few days have been a wake-up call for everybody, we in the NANDG have struggled to overcome our intense feelings of isolation enough to join hands in a nationwide movement, a demand by those of us excluded from normal school life to stop the ridicule, stop the bullying.
That's a tall order.
Oh, listen, we plead guilty to being idealists, the kind of kids who 30 years ago would have protested the Vietnam War, no questions asked. But, you know, we're realistic, too. We know that guns will always be with us, so you've got to look at the root causes of teen violence, and that's mistreatment at the hands of friends or, more commonly, classmates who wouldn't be caught dead hanging out with us.
This mistreatment would basically consist of name-calling?
You know, that's trivializing it. Name-calling is just putting it so mildly. Mm-hmm. What's going on in the hallways and lunchrooms of American schools is nothing less than what President Bush would, you know, might describe as the soft bigotry of bigotry itself. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't make fun of black people anymore, or Latino people, or handicapped people, really anybody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, my dad told me they used to tell Polish jokes, but, you know, in my school, that can get you suspended.
So the only safe target left is...
Us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because of our tendency to low self-esteem anyway, we just tend not to file complaints about these incidents, so we really have no idea how widespread ridicule and bullying really are, but we all know.
Christian, I ask this question taking the risk that it brands me as a hopelessly out-of-touch fuddy-duddy as well as the closet bluegrass mandolin player that our listeners have heard at the end of several news magazines.
Uh-huh.
But has it occurred to your members that we've always had bullies and somewhat cruel class clowns?
Uh-huh. You know, Mr. Zipkin, for a long time they always had slavery. Then one day they didn't anymore. You know, we don't look at this in terms of always before. We look at it in terms of never again.
Mr. Borges, I understand you've rejected a demand that your group make a commitment to nonviolence.
Yeah, that so-called demand was made by a spokesman for the National Goth Council. And, you know, we don't see them as a legitimate spokesman for the goth kids. Those kids, and I say this with all respect, they have no idea what a democratic membership organization would even look like, you know. Mm. It's like, you know, bite off my ear and I'll follow you everywhere type deal, you know. So, yeah, we reserve the right to send a message to the bullies and the fun pokers and send that message in the only language that they understand, which is senseless violence.
Well, given the amount of weapons that seem to be on or around our school campuses these days, Mr. Borges, is what you're threatening basically like a nationwide youth gang war?
Well, A, we're not a gang. We're an incredibly active youth organization.
Well, dorks and nerds do tend to like running school clubs and such, don't they?
I don't know, Mr. Zipkin, do we? You see, you wouldn't dare say that about any other group, but somebody painted a kick me on our behinds, and I'm telling you this, I'm not going to graduate from high school until I get that message off of there.
This may seem cruel, but we don't have much time left. Have you and your members ever thought about just putting on some weight and getting some contact lenses?
Mr. Zipkin, my stepmom has told me about the Stockholm Syndrome. You know, that's what this is. You were obviously a nerd or a geek or a dork yourself in school, and yet you're identifying with the popular kids, the athletes, and the dweebs on the student council. I find that inexpressibly sad.
Well, I try to keep myself out of my interviews as much as possible. So,
well,
let me just thank you for joining us, Christian Borges, president of the National Association.
I'm executive chairman. Our president is this fat kid.
Noted. Of Geeks, Dorks, and Nerds. I'm Ira Zipkin.
And for now, that's all of All in All. Funding for this program came from the William and Giselle Shyskoff Foundation, supporting the coverage of everything except tax-exempt foundations. I'm Milton Getzler, reminding you there's always more of All in All. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Love, people are there, the smile.
Well, let's say what's happening on the national scene, the national political scene. What do you say, ladies and gentlemen? First of all, just mopping up some old business. The CIA did get it wrong pretty much a lot of the time, especially when it came to the quantum Soviet Union, partly because even though they did know better, they didn't have the guts to say so. Jack Matlock, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow back then, when George Shultz was Secretary of State, said Shultz was afraid to speak frankly about his views on Gorbachev, who basically dismantled the Soviet system, because he knew his rivals in the Reagan administration, particularly Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and National Security Advisor Robert Gates, would accuse him of being hopelessly naive if he did. This is from a conference the CIA held, releasing some documents to show just how little they did know. How little they knew. They implicitly confirmed that the big events of the Gorbachev years virtually all caught the CIA by surprise. No evidence that the agency anticipated the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, the release of dissident physicist Andrei Sakharov from internal exile, the effective end of censorship, unilateral cuts in the Soviet armed forces, Gorbachev's willingness to accept huge reductions in conventional arms and missiles, or his acquiescence in the collapse of the Eastern European Empire. Douglas McKeegan, who headed the CIA's Office of Soviet Analysis during the 80s, told how difficult it was to get cautions based on Soviet economic difficulties into the national intelligence estimates on Soviet military programs. In an interview, he said, "We gave up on the national intelligence estimates after 86 or 87 because it was so difficult to get realistic assessments into them." But who needs realism when you got intelligence? Today's intelligence tells us that, according to the Palm Beach Post, the famous butterfly ballot cost Al Gore 6,607 votes in Palm Beach County, more than enough to make him the winner of the presidential election. This conflicts, of course, with the count in Miami-Dade, but that involved many fewer votes. That came out a couple weeks ago that made it look as if George W. Bush won the election. You figure it out. Oh, you have? Okay, fine. In today's New York Times, we learn this, a telling difference between George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. By the estimation of Andrew Card, the Bush chief of staff, George W. Bush devoted, quote, in the neighborhood of 5 hours to meetings to discuss his budget proposal. By contrast, the former president, Clinton, spent at least 25 hours in official meetings assembling his first budget and 50 hours more in casual settings. So that would be 75 hours for Clinton, 5 hours for George W. Bush. Says Kenneth Duberstein, who was the chief of staff for Ronald Reagan, "This is the first time in American history we've had a president and a prime minister," referring to Dick Cheney, who had a little episode, had to go into the hospital this week to have his arteries revivified. As to the tax cut that sailed through the House this week on a party line vote, it's an interesting quote from Lawrence Kudlow, former advisor to President Reagan and an opinionator. "Since business isn't getting anything in the first tax bill, they're getting to get a lot on the regulatory side." That's the desire of Bush and the Republican-led Congress to reward corporate groups for foregoing requesting tax breaks in the tax cut bill that's going through now, while reserving the right to press for special provisions later on. Now, I thought, listening to conservative economists, that corporations don't pay taxes. Isn't that what they say whenever it's proposed that it be raised, the corporate income tax? Corporations don't pay taxes. They pass them all on to the consumer. But when the topic is cutting taxes, says Lawrence Kudlow, a Wall Street economist, business isn't getting anything in the first tax bill, so they're going to get a lot on the regulatory side. I can't make heads or tails of it. But anyway, as you know, President Bush campaigned in several states with Democratic senators for his tax cut bill this week, and then flew home to his ranch to spend the weekend there, possibly to receive one of those phone calls he sometimes gets from the 41st president of the United States, his not-so-immediate predecessor.
Air Force One, this is, hold on just a sec. Where's that list of code names, Karen? I probably shouldn't call you Karen either. You got a code name on here.
Hey,
43, know who you are. This is 41 calling. That's code enough, don't you think? Of course, but I really am supposed to know these, I guess. Look, son, it's just the Secret Service making themselves feel useful. If somebody unauthorized did get that phone number, you think answering him with a code name would throw him off? That's real late night at Yale bull session type thinking there, Dad. I don't know that I'm up to it after the week I've had. What are you talking about? I have to congratulate you on a great week. You got the tax cut bill through the House, yeah. Got the rollback of Clinton rules through both houses. Uh-huh. Hey, if you listen to Jim Baker tell it, that's more than we accomplished in 4 years. Listen, 41, you know exactly why this was such a nightmarish time for me. This whole Dick Cheney thing is turning into the biggest loser I've been saddled with since I bought into the Texas Rangers.
Hey, we turned that one around with a little help from the taxpayers. Nothing wrong with Dick Cheney. He just had to have, what do they call it, a procedure.
Let me ask you something. Yeah. How am I supposed to know for sure that he didn't have a heart attack this time? You know, in November, when he did have a heart thing, I was the last guy in the planet that they told. Mm-hmm. That's just embarrassing to be put in a position where people might perceive me as an ignoramus.
And 43, look here. Yeah. Cheney himself told me you have nothing to worry about.
Well, of course he's going to tell you that. You're the guy that sold me this lemon.
He is not a lemon.
Well, he sure ain't cherry.
Don't even know what that means. Don't want to know. Look, if you put something inside an artery, sometimes the artery's going to react negatively to it. You know, same thing we do.
Okay.
So that's what happened to Dick Cheney's heart. You know this. You've had it all explained to you.
If you're asking, do I pay total 100% attention to every single briefing, you know the answer is no. I have to keep my focus. Even Karl Rove says that, yeah. As far as I'm concerned, detail is like retail. Who needs it?
Yeah.
So whatever did or didn't go on in Dick Cheney's arteries is between him and his maker. But looky here,
yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I love Dick Cheney. He's a good man. I know what's in his heart. He's got a good heart, but, you know, his real heart is just a piece of crap. So what am I supposed to do? Start mastering this place all of a sudden just in case? You know, I'm a heartbeat away from being the President of the United States. So, yeah, what me worry?
Son.
What?
Jeez, you know, get a grip. You're flying off the handle like some kind of Italian fella. Yeah, even keel.
Uh-huh.
You got plenty of people around you, big support system.
Well, that's the other thing. Condi's not talking to Colin. Colin thinks Rumsfeld's bad-mouthing him behind his back, which he is. You know, these are the people who are supposed to be helping me, and I'm spending half my time hearing them bitch about each other.
They're not scared of you yet. They only fight over turf until you make them scared of you. Then they buckle down.
Well, you know what? If Dick Cheney, or as I call him, Sick Cheney, goes in for one more procedure, I'm going to be scared of me. Can't you get me someone else in there?
Hey, look, he's not going to resign. From what the docs tell me, he's probably not going to die anytime soon. He was elected, same as you, maybe even more than you. He's yours.
41, this is straight from the shooter. No one would rather lean on Dick Cheney than me. But, you know, I just had this recurring nightmare of calling his cell phone during some national emergency and having to rely on advice from a candy striper. That's just not good enough.
All right, look, if you want me to have a conversation with him about what?
Just tell him to knock off the goddamn procedures. You know, if I just could see him for 3 straight months without a hospital wristband on him, I might start feeling confident about him again.
Well, maybe he could mask it as a trip to Camp David or Canada.
Well, whatever. As I say, he's a darn good man.
Yeah.
But, you know, you didn't have to try to get a last-minute briefing on Korea from him while he was zonked on Demerol.
Lucky bastard. Listen here. I'm going to talk to him. Don't let it rattle you. You had a good week.
You think?
I know. Now just relax. Take the weekend off.
Well, sure.
Okay. Love to Laura. Yeah, tell Mrs. 41 I said hi.
And this in this morning's New York Times, the Washington State Senate has passed legislation aimed at cracking down on bullying. No specific penalties were set. I'm beginning to believe that no student body presidents listen to this broadcast. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, over the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the Armed Forces Network, on shortwave, for goodness sake, at WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz on your shortwave dial, and on your computer whenever you want it at www.kcrw.com. That's spelled KCRW. And it would be just like originating next week from Washington, D.C., if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, because interactivity is such an integral part of this broadcast, just a part of the weft and the warp and the woof, don't you know? I once again remind you that to email this broadcast, send your missives to Limail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. And say it with me, no attachments, please. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.